From Philadelphia, it's Torah Talk. Hello everyone, I'm Michael Karasik, and this week we are reading Parshat Toledot, Genesis 25:19 through 28:9. And this is the parasha, really the one parasha that focuses on the story of Isaac. Isaac is only mentioned 108 times in the Bible, in 101 verses, and more than a third of the mentions of Isaac anywhere in the Bible are in this week's parasha. So let's pay some attention to him, starting at the beginning of Genesis 26. There was a famine in the land, aside from the previous famine that had occurred in the days of Abraham, and Isaac went to Abimelech, king of the Philistines, in Gerar. The Lord had appeared to him and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Stay in the land which I point out to you. Reside in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. I will assign all these lands to you and to your heirs, fulfilling the oath that I swore to your father Abraham. I will make your heirs as numerous as the stars of heaven, and assign to your heirs all these lands, so that the nations of the earth shall bless themselves by your heirs. Inasmuch as Abraham obeyed me and kept my charge, my commandments, my laws, and my teachings." Well, there's a lot in those five verses that sounds a lot like Isaac's father Abraham. Nations of the earth shall bless themselves by you. I will make you as numerous as the stars of heaven. You will get this land because I'm fulfilling the oath. I will be with you and bless you. The big difference, of course, is that when in Genesis 12 there was a famine in the land, Abram went down to Egypt. And here God tells Isaac, "Do not go down to Egypt." And for those who need a little bit of updating about where we are in the story, this is the story that scholars used to call, at least, the matriarch of Israel in danger. In Genesis 12, when Abram goes down to Egypt, in Genesis 20, when Abram himself sojourns in Gerar, and now here in Genesis 26, when it's Isaac who is in Gerar, the king takes a fancy to the patriarch's wife and brings her into the palace, and hilarity ensues. So there's three stories that all more or less fit together. This is the one of those three stories that's not about Abraham, but about Isaac. Here's John Levinson in the Jewish Study Bible. He says, "Here the Lord affirms the continuity of Isaac with his father, whose experience he in part relives. Isaac will fall heir to the Abrahamic promise of offspring, blessing, and land." See the verses that he cites in his comment. They're all on the handout for you. Verse 5 may be a reference to the Akedah, the only explicit one in the Tanakh outside of chapter 22. It sure ain't explicit, and I kind of don't think it's a reference at all, but he could be right. Can't complain. Anyway, what I want to look at is this phrase that you'll see highlighted in verse 1, aside from the previous famine, Milvad Hara'av Harishon, the one that had occurred in the days of Abraham. This word milvad, or you can disassemble it and reassemble it in the other direction, not mi levad, but levad mi, really except from, or from except, means besides or except. I have a couple of examples on the handout for you. In Genesis 46:26, all the persons belonging to Jacob who came to Egypt, Milvad, the wives of Jacob's sons, all numbered 66. And in Exodus 12, the Israelites journeyed from Ramses to Sukkot, about 600,000 men on foot, levad me, children. And you can have a look at the Brown, Driver, and Briggs definition of this phrase, which lists a bunch of other examples for you, many other examples for you. They say that milvad, the inverted one, is chiefly P and late. P, the priestly text, and late, meaning post-exilic. So Robert Alter says on this phrase, besides the former famine, the writer, some would say the editor, signals at the outset that this story comes after and explicitly reenacts what happened before to Abraham. My question is, why do you have to signal it so clumsily? Here's Klaus Westermann in the Continental Commentary to Genesis, English translation of it. He says the natural continuation of verse 1 is verse 6, so Isaac remained in Gerar. This suggests that verses 2 through 5 are an addition, but the text of 2 through 5 is not in itself a unity. If you like dismantling the text of the Torah, Klaus Westermann is the guy for you, and you can read more in his version of the commentary. Joel Baden, a much more recent scholar, says essentially the same thing as Westermann for a completely different reason. He has an article in the journal Hebrew Studies, A Narrative Pattern and Its Role in Source Criticism. And what he says is there's a standard trope for the fulfillment of a command. A command is issued in the imperative, followed by the remainder of the speech between the two characters, and then the immediate fulfillment of the command using the same verb in the same binyan in the vav consecutive. If you don't know the grammatical terms, it doesn't matter. He's describing in precise grammatical terms a particular narrative pattern that repeats itself in the Torah that seems to be found not quite as he describes it in our passage. And what he says is, if the natural continuation of verse 1 is verse 6, and you remove verses 2 through 5, then the malfunctioning example of the pattern that seems to be in the text is not actually there. Not that the function, that the pattern functions properly, but it's not there at all. And so, for a completely different reason, he wants to remove verses 2 through 5. But the phrase that I'm having a problem with is still there if you remove verses 2 through 5. This kind of clunky reference, Milvad Hara'av Harishon. David Frankel in the Torah.com says, the verse reads very well without the words, aside from the previous famine that had occurred in the days of Abraham. The insertion begins with the word milvad, which, as noted by Israel Knoll, introduces late editorial comments throughout the Pentateuch. Well, I'm not so convinced that the examples that I gave you on page 1 of the handout from Genesis 46 and Exodus 12 are late editorial comments, and not the other ones in the Torah also don't seem to me to call quite so much attention to themselves as this one does. The insertion, says Frankel, helps to incorporate the story within the narrative flow of Genesis by presenting Isaac's famine as a second famine. the first being that which caused Abraham to descend to Egypt in Genesis 12:10. Well, Frankl's analysis, which seems rather radical to me, but it's on thetorah.com, so you can Google it and read it for yourself. He ends up saying, this analysis suggests that the original narrative presented all of Isaac's efforts in this chapter as his own unprecedented achievements. They originally had nothing to do with Abraham, and yet the Isaac and Abraham stories retain many parallels. The famine, Gerar, the wife's sister's story, wealth, oath, Beersheba. So if the Isaac stories were originally independent, the Abraham stories must be borrowing from Isaac and not vice versa. That's hard for me to believe, but I have to agree that this phrase, aside from the previous famine, is very strange. How do the traditional interpreters look at it? Rashbam says, the previous famine, from Genesis 12:10, the point is to let us know that Isaac too was heading for Egypt via Philistia, the shortest route, and that's why God had to stop him. But he doesn't really address why there had to be a famine to get Isaac to go down there. Kimchi, Radak as he's also known, says this was the first famine that had occurred since then, and Gersonides expands on that a little bit more. These were the only 2 years of famine that had occurred there since Abraham came to the land. Whether because, as Deuteronomy 11 says, it's a land which the Lord your God looks after, on which the Lord your God always keeps his eye from year's beginning to year's end, or because of the special providence extended personally to Abraham and Isaac. That is what Isaac Abarbanel thinks. The Holy One did not want Abraham to have to go down to Egypt again, as he had during the original famine, but he caused another famine immediately after Abraham's death to let the inhabitants know that the plenty they had experienced was due to Abraham's merit. But now we turn to Nachmanides, who has an explanation not really that different from David Frankl's, but one, of course, that perfectly fits in with Jewish tradition and does not presume that later editors were dismantling and rewriting the Torah. So here is Nachmanides. Aside from the previous famine that had occurred in the days of Abraham, which, says Nachmanides, may perhaps have been the first famine in the history of the world. Otherwise, what would be the point of mentioning it? But I think we're being told that everyone remembered that famine and how Abraham had gone down to Egypt because of it, and by God's grace gained great honor there, so it would be natural for Isaac too to think of going down there in this situation, explaining why he had to be told not to. I think there is an allusion to the future here. Just as Abraham's exile to Egypt by famine symbolizes his descendants' exile there. Now, Abraham's sojourn in Gerar was not an exile. He settled there voluntarily. But Isaac's going down to Gerar was forced on him by the famine. And Gerar was the land where, quote, his father had sojourned. So it must allude to the exile to Babylonia, where the ancestors of the patriarchs had originally lived. In this exile, at least, they do not start out by taking his wife, see verse 11. Still, he is in exile and afraid, but eventually they tell him, go away from us, that's in verse 16, and still later they come back to him and say in verse 28, let there be a sworn treaty between our two parties. Now, says Nachmanides, This is just what happened to those who were exiled to Babylonia. They were exiled there amidst the fever of famine, see Lamentations 5:10. But once there, they were not enslaved or oppressed. Eventually, some of them became high officials, and finally they were told, "Any one of you of all his people, may his God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem, that is in Judah, and build the house of the Lord God of Israel." The decree of Cyrus from the beginning of the book of Ezra. That is, this story is written in the Torah in such a way as to allude to something that will happen to the descendants of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob 1,000 years later in the 6th century BCE. That aspect of it is not so different from what David Frankel says on thetorah.com. When the text was written is quite different from the two perspectives, but the fact that literature is alluding to a different moment in history is shared by Frankel and Nachmanides. I like the fact that you can come at the text from two such different perspectives and circle around and come back more or less to a very similar understanding of what the text is telling us. I'll be back with you next week for Parshat Vayetze. Until then, this is Michael Karasik saying, thanks for listening.